Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of Under the Radar SFF Books Podcast. I'm your host, Blaze, as always. Thank you so much for listening and joining me wherever you may be around the world. And this is a very special author interview because this is covering my top standalone epic fantasy novel of all time. So I'm pleased to be joined by Peter A. Flannery, the author of Battle Mage, an epic fantasy standalone that exceeds every expectation you could ever have. Peter, welcome to the program. Thank you so much for joining.
It's my pleasure, Blaze. Thanks for having me.
Oh, anytime. So Battle Mage just captured my heart when I read it, and then I went back and actually listened to it. The audiobooks are just fantastic. But let's go back. What made you want to become a writer in the first place? What drew you to the genre of fantasy?
Two questions, really. So with respect to becoming a writer, that was something that actually, for me, the seeds were sown really early in life. I remember being in school when I was quite young, maybe about 8 or 9, and the teacher asked us to write a poem. So me being the typical sort of lazy child that I was, I just wrote some nonsense little poem about stars. They twinkle here, they twinkle there, they twinkle everywhere. And she gave me a right good telling off. And she said she was very disappointed and she thought I could do better. So suitably chastened, I went and sat down. And I thought about it for a little while, and I wrote a poem called When All Is Quiet. And it was very simple, but it was When All Is Quiet, I Hear the Clock Tick, and that kind of thing. So I sheepishly took this up to the teacher, handed it over. She read it through, and I swear she almost had a tear in her eye. And then she gave it back to me, and she said, "That's much better." And as I walked away from her desk, I was struck by this sensation that, oh my goodness, something I've just written has had that effect on another person. And even though I was really, really young at the time, it made a big impression on me. And that's kind of stayed with me ever since. But it was being a writer is kind of like being a Premier League football player or a music star. You kind of don't really think it's possible. So it was always in the back of my mind, but I never really thought of it as a realistic possibility. So I was always writing, whether it was, you know, teenage angst poems as a teenager or my first attempts at writing fantasy stories after reading Lord of the Rings and things like this. So in the background, I was always writing, but I was kind of jumping about from one career path to another as I sort of moved through life. So, yeah, the sort of path becoming a writer was always there. And then it just kind of developed, and you look for opportunities to make it a reality as you get older. When it comes to fantasy, I suspect, like a lot of your listeners, that seems to be something that's just always been inside me. From my earliest memories of being excited about other people's creations, it was things like Jason and the Argonauts, Sinbad the Sailor, reading The Hobbit at school. These kind of things just captured my imagination. And I think what most of us do is we start off imitating the things we really like. You know, so we've all written our own version of Lord of the Rings. We've all written our own version of, you know, various things that have inspired us. But I just remember being so excited about those things. And as a kid, I used to do that. In America, do you have things called Smarties? They're like M&Ms, different colored little candies.
Yes, we did.
I used to do this thing on the floor of my bedroom where I would split the Smarties into different colors, and each color would be a different army. But whichever was the smallest number of colors, they would always be the Spartans. Okay, so if it was the red that only had like 7 Smarties, all the others would be the Persian army around them. And then as they were killed, I would eat the Smarties, of course, until all the Spartans were gone. So the seeds of fantasy were sown really early. And it's just something that just latched onto me, just must have suited my character or something. Something about the drama and the sort of the rise of the hero and that fight between good and evil. All those classic things. So, yeah, that's basically how I'd be sort of my path to being a writer in terms of just the origins, and the same with fantasy.
Awesome. let's talk a little bit about your writing process, because a lot of the authors who I interview have a different writing process. When you were writing, let's say, Battle Mage, did you have everything in your head and you knew how everything was going to be? Or was it like you had an idea of like big points in the story that you were going to write to and you kind of, and the story just kind of wrote itself?
For me, it's a little bit of a mixture of both. You know, they have these people who they say they write by the seat of their pants, or they have their planners. I definitely plan things, but I always try and keep the plans fairly loose, because if you keep it too tight, it's constraining and it doesn't allow room for things to grow. So with Battle Mage, again, that was a culmination of just basically a lifetime of inspiration from other things. So I had the basic idea, because essentially Battle Mage is just the classic coming-of-age fantasy tale. And I make no apologies for that, because that was what I wanted to write. I just wanted to try and do a good job of doing that particular type of story. And like I said before, I started numerous novels over the years and got maybe a few chapters in or halfway and gave up. And some of it's about your own sort of maturity and your own voice as a writer. To begin with, that's not necessarily very strong, but you develop an identity. So I developed this identity as a writer, and then that helped to sort of bring some of these very familiar ideas, bring them into the light in a different way, so that they started to feel as if I was, yes, I was using a lot of fantasy tropes and I was using a lot of very familiar ideas, but I felt as if I was adding something of myself to the story. So then that feels a lot more comfortable, because you don't feel like you're copying. You feel like you're actually adding to the canon of fantasy rather than just, you know, repeating it. And then when it comes down to the ideas, I always think of it as like, if you think of your top 10 list of things that should go in a fantasy book, it was almost like I was ticking them off. So the ultimate mythical beast for me and for a lot of people is a dragon. So dragons are going to be front and center. I've always loved history in general and historical fantasy. So I wanted my world to feel almost like a parallel world to our world. So I didn't want to have different races with dwarves and elves and things. Those are all superb, but I wanted mine to almost feel like it was a mirror image of Europe in this fantasy setting. But one of the problems I've always felt in terms of getting excited about wars and getting excited about basically people killing each other, I always feel uncomfortable if it's humans fighting humans, because it's never a simple case of goodies and baddies. You know, there's always two sides to the story. So I didn't want to essentially just have two factions that could each justify their position in a war. I essentially wanted my baddies to be evil, you know, the very embodiment of evil. And that meant that I could feel comfortable destroying them or fighting against them. So that was the basic premise. So you start off with the basic. You've got the sort of the nobility of the knights. You've got the terror and the horror of the demons. You've got the glory and the power of the dragons. But then you've got the sort of the human element. And for me, that's one of the most powerful things. And I think my impression of the human's contribution, just ordinary humans, so ordinary people who aren't, you know, powerful wizards or super warriors, is almost like the power of the Force, you know, from Star Wars. It's something subtle. It's something humble, but it's also really powerful. So all those elements kind of came together to form the basis of my story. And then I just allowed the story to sort of flow from that starting point. And if you take somebody who starts off weak and you make them strong, you know, George Martin is a master of that. If you think of Game of Thrones, everyone at the start of the book who starts off weak or manipulated or abused ends up being the strongest. You know, whether it's Bran getting thrown out of a window or Sansa being manipulated and used. Arya starts off a little kid, but they all grow up to be the strongest. You know, even the bastard in Jon Snow, he ends up being So it's there's a phrase in the Bible, the first shall be last and the last shall be first. And I think there's something quite powerful about that. So that was what sort of all came together to produce Battle Mage, really.
Awesome. And you're right. Battle Mage has a lot of the quote-unquote classical fantasy tropes. It has a coming of age. It has classical, has knights. It has tournaments. It has archers and dragons and mages. But the way you put it all together in a cohesive story and the way you write your characters, some very, very touching and emotional moments throughout the course of this book, just they stick with me. Just brilliant job done. For Battle Mage, what made you want to condense the story into one standalone novel as opposed to writing it out in like a series or a trilogy?
This was something I felt really strongly about right from the start. Like a lot of people, I grew up reading fantasy books, the Belgariad and the Wheel of Time and the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, all these sort of brilliant fantasy books, David Gemmell. But what started to happen was that what began as the classic fantasy trilogy then became extended. So instead of it just being three books, then the story became extended. So it was four books, five books, six books, seven books. And it was while reading the Wheel of Time, even though I was still enjoying it, I got to the point where I just thought it was just going on. So when I came to write my big sort of fantasy book, I thought to myself, no, I'm telling a story. I'm telling one story, and I want it to be one big book. Lord of the Rings was never intended to be split up into three books. It was always intended as a single book. And that's the way I wanted mine to be. Not that I'm comparing it to Lord of the Rings, but in that respect. And just about everybody I spoke to, I've got a lot of writers in the local area that I you know, meet up with and have coffee with. And they were all trying to convince me that I should split it up into three books. And I was adamant, no. I want it to be one book, one experience, and then it would be a case of, have you read Battle Mage? Not, have you read the first one? So that was it, really. And I still think the chances are I might have made more money, you know, if I'd split it up into three books, and it might have kept a continuation going for longer. But it's just not what I wanted to do. So I stuck with the one book, and a large percentage of the reviews I get mention the fact that they like the fact that it was a standalone book. So I find that really gratifying because it feels to me like I made the right choice.
I'd say you did as well. And because there's not too many standalone fantasy books of this length in the genre. So this just stands out, especially the first time I saw it on Goodreads. I saw like, wow, it has over 8,000 views, but no one talks about this. I don't know why. So I read it, I listened to it, and I absolutely fell in love with it. And then the whole thing started for me. But with that, why don't we talk about the story? So could you just tell the audience, because you're the better one to talk about it than I am, just give like a brief synopsis of what the story is about, and then we can talk about the characters, because the characters here just shine through tremendously.
Sure, I'll do my best. So it takes place in a medieval fantasy world, and each of the kingdoms or nations in this world I loosely based on some nation within Europe, and that just gave me a cohesive kind of idea of how to tie the world together. I started out making up fantasy words and making up fantasy languages, and I very quickly fell out of love with that because it felt like it was being made up. I'm not a Tolkien. I'm not a Ricardo Pinto. I can't make up an entire language, you know, with syntax and everything. So it takes place in this fantasy medieval world, and it follows the story of a young man who's lived under the shadow of his father's actions. So many years ago, his father was a battle mage being a warrior who can use magic. And if you just imagine a Jedi Knight in a fantasy setting, that's essentially what a battle mage is. So he starts out young, he starts out ill, but he starts out with a true heart. So his best friend is the classic blacksmith's son. Big, strong, powerful, and absolutely loyal to each other to the very end. And that is the crux of the story, really, is that loyalty and that friendship between the characters. That's the bedrock upon which everything else is built. So he starts out in this town, and the town is currently under threat from an army which is led by a demon. Now, the armies are possessed. So these are human warriors who've been overtaken by evil. So they're very hard to defeat because they don't really react to pain or damage. They just keep coming until you absolutely destroy them or hack them to pieces, basically. Now, the warriors in themselves aren't particularly hugely powerful. They're equivalent to human warriors in many respects. But when they're led by a demon is different. A demon is an actual creature from essentially another dimension. And in the book, I call it hell, and I picture it as being a version of hell. So these are literally demons from hell that have come into our world with the sole intent of enslaving the soul of humankind. So they basically lead these armies of possessed warriors. And one of these armies is heading towards the main character's hometown of Caer Dor. It's a mountain town. So the entire town is very nervous because they know their own army isn't strong enough to protect them. However, there's one of their members of their society is coming back from finishing his training, and he's trained as a battle mage. Now, a battle mage gives ordinary soldiers the courage to stand and fight in the presence of a demon. A normal person, a normal soldier, even the bravest knight, there's something about that fear that radiates from a demon that's impossible for a normal person to resist. So I wanted the battle mages to be not just powerful warriors, but like totems of faith. So if you think of the effect that somebody like Julius Caesar would have on a battle, or Alexander the Great, their very presence could turn the tide of an entire battle, because they would inspire their own troops and they would intimidate the enemy. So this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to have these battle mages as these totems that gave human warriors the ability to stand and fight. And then you could have a fair fight. So you've got demons, battle mages, and then the two opposing armies. So it begins in the mountains with this demon army approaching. And Falco Dante, the main character, he's weak and sickly, but he's got a good, strong heart, you know, in terms of his spirit. And the guy who's coming, the battle mage that's coming, he's just about to go and try and summon a dragon. And if he can get a dragon to fight by his side, then basically they'd be unstoppable because it's just such a powerful combination. So he goes up into the mountains to try and summon a dragon. But then Falco has this sort of insight, this instinct that something's not right, that something's wrong. And he interrupts the summoning. Things go a bit pear-shaped, you know, things go a bit disastrous. And it turns out that the people in the town have to evacuate and flee into the mountains to try and get to safety. And I've had some people saying that at this point they gave up the book because they thought, oh, you're so stupid and what have you. But for me, it's the entire crux of the book, because they see it as he's doing something wrong or he's making a mistake. But actually what Falco's doing is that instinct inside of him is actually responding to the truth. He's responding to something deep within him that he knows is wrong. So even though his actions caused something very bad, what he was doing was acting on good faith. So that takes the characters from their hometown and sends them on the typical sort of journey of maturity. You know, they start to grow up, they become more exposed to the world, they're taken out of their small little town and thrown into much bigger events and much bigger picture of the world. And they head for the capital of another kingdom, which is far away from the fighting, where they go into something called the Academy of War. And yes, it's got that sort of Hogwarts, Harry Potter kind of feel to it. You've got your bullies and you've got your professors and you've got your students. So it's that same kind of mix. And there, Malachi, who's a very strong and skilled warrior, he just gets better and grows into his sort of potential. But then there's other characters like Brynn and Godwin. I really enjoy writing strong female characters, but I'm wary not to try and just take a female and put it in a typical male strong role. I don't know if that makes sense. So, Brynna Godwin is this, she's a typical sort of fiery young woman, but she comes from the noble class, so she's slightly different to Malachi and Falco. But essentially her spirit is the same as theirs. She's courageous, she's loyal, and she's witty. So those three are like the core group, and they're what sort of carry people through. And they cover most of the bases. And then accompanying them and supporting them, you have some of the classic characters. You've got your mentor figure, you know, your Obi-Wan Kenobi figure in the form of Simeon, or then he kind of passes on the mantle to an old seasoned knight called the Emissary. So these characters are really important because they support the youngsters. They bring in that wisdom and that experience that the youngsters don't have. But they also allow for that essential passing of the baton, you know, that passing of responsibility. When the youngsters come of age, then they can take on the responsibility of fighting the world and doing those things. So this core of characters goes off to the port city of Wrath, and there they undergo training, and they slowly get stronger and more confident and more capable until they reach the end of their training, where they go off on what's essentially like a training mission to practice leading armies. Now, I've had some people say that the progression happens too quickly, that people don't train that quickly. And there's some truth in that. But I face this issue of either maintaining the pace or having it more realistic. If you've got a young person who's going to spend 3 or 4 years training to become a leader of people, then the threat can't be that imminent. Does that make sense? So I had to try and find a happy medium between it being believable that they could amass these skills to be able to sort of take on the responsibility of leading armies, but without it undermining the pace of the novel or that sense of imminent danger. So, yes, we end up with this core group of characters starting to become leaders of men. So they become the leaders of the army. And then from there, they then are taken to the front of the war, where they have to put their skills into practice. And they have all these revelations of how terrible it is and the responsibility of sending people into dangerous situations, of losing soldiers under their command. So there's all this kind of emotional progression of coming to coming to terms with the reality of war. And then working alongside that is this sort of ever-present threat of the possessed, because they're just on this relentless march across the land. So they're overtaking cities, they're capturing more territory. Every time they capture an area, a large portion of the people there become possessed. So each time their armies grow stronger. So if you allow them to just keep capturing territory, you're just allowing the enemy to get stronger and stronger. So you literally have to take that extra step and say, no, we've got to try and stop them here. And this is what I tried to do. And one of the key characters that comes into play when the youngsters reach the city is Queen Catherine. So this is Queen Catherine of Wrath, and she's almost like a Joan of Arc type figure. You know, she's this strong royal leader, but she's also very approachable. And you know, there's a little bit of a love story going on. I don't like to overplay sort of romance and that too much. For me, I find that can be a distraction. But there's a love story there that sort of underpins some of the characters' relationships, and that gives a lot of meaning to events that happen. And it also puts a lot of emphasis. So the consequences of things happening seem a lot more pronounced to the reader. So if you really care about your characters, then what happens in a battle really matters. If you don't particularly care about your characters, then whatever, if they get killed, that's no big deal. So this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to sort of generate this sort of this anticipation whereby people think, oh, my God, what if they die kind of thing, you know. But all the time you've got this buildup of just how horrible and how terrible the demons are. And then I try and bring it all to a point. And I did that at several points in the book whereby a lot of things that are happening slowly start to converge, and they come to a certain point. And if you can manage to get the timing right for all these different things, then what you're basically doing is you're it's like putting money into a bank account. If you invest in these scenes from early on, so if you invest in sort of logical terms, in sort of strategic terms, and in emotional terms, then when you reach these powerful scenes, the payoff is much, much greater. So, yeah, we've got the three main characters, Falco Dante, Malachy Devane, and Brynna Godwin. They're supported by Queen Catherine of Wrath, by the Emissary, and then they're sort of joined by a cantankerous old battle mage who lost an arm in an earlier fight with a battle with a demon. So together they form this core group, and there are the sort of conventional people who don't have the same kind of faith in these people. How can these youngsters lead an army? And in the background you've got the Magi, which are almost like a priesthood, and they're very jealous of the battle mages. So they want power for themselves, but they don't have the power of a battle mage. So again, you've got this sort of political conflict a little bit between the Magi and the rulers, because the Magi want to have influence over the kings and queens, but they know they can't do what a battle mage can do. So this leads to a final confrontation, and there are other threads, sort of more personal, subtle threads with evil characters insinuating into certain areas. And there's one of my favorite characters, a character called Meredith, who begins as a mage, but he has this sort of uncomfortable niggle in the back of his mind that everything's not quite right. So he plays a significant part, and they're all different sort of threads interweaving, but all culminating in this final battle, where I just wanted it to have that absolutely epic feel, for it to have that emotional impact, and then for it to sort of finish with this really satisfying punch. So that's what I was aiming for the whole time. But for a long time, as I was writing the book, I couldn't quite decide how the end was going to work. And I started getting really nervous because I thought, okay, I've got all these threads coming together, but I can't quite get in my head the timing and the actual sort of the choreography of the end scene. But slowly, if you have a bit of faith and you just work through the problems, I slowly started to sort of make it work and work and work. And when I'd done it, I kind of sat back and I thought, okay, I think that works. And then it was like, oh my God, you know, you just take a massive sigh of relief, and then you've got to tighten it up and neaten it and sharpen up all the edges, got it kind of thing. So I don't know if that really answers your question or whatever, but that was the process.
But one part I wanted to talk more about was the calling of the battle mage calling the dragon, because there's little intricacies on that I just wanted to share with our audience, who just give them one more thing to want to pick up this book. So you're right. In the beginning, Falco, he goes and he witnesses a battle mage doing a calling, and that's the calling of the dragon. But when they're calling the dragon, they were surrounded by magi, because they need them for protection. And the thing about magi is versus battle mages have the ability to use magic right away. The magi have to, like, days or even weeks to get all their sustenance and all their source of magic ready for any type of magical use. So for a calling, there's three possibilities. The first possibility is that nothing happens. The dragon doesn't hear the calling. Yeah. Second possibility, a dragon calls, arrives, and then they join with the battle mage and they become partners. The third one is a dragon comes, but it's black. And black dragons in this book, you make them mad and with vengeance, and they want to destroy everybody that they see. What you do with that over the course of the book is just so fascinating. But can you just tell me about when you were writing that calling scene? We're not going to talk about the ramifications of it, but what was picturing in your mind and how you wanted that to relate to the audience?
So that was one of those scenes that was kind of loaded in reverse, if you get what I'm saying. So some scenes you load from the front. So you build up anticipation, or you lay threads so that at the end of the book, the payoff at that scene is more powerful. But sometimes what you do is you have things at the end of the book that have significance to this point. So at the start, it has impact because it's very dramatic, and it's tragic and it's sad, but it's also terrible. But what it does is then from that point, then it grows and it gives you the ability to then use that to make it more significant as the book progresses. So instead of bringing everything to the point of a battle's victory, you start with a point of tragedy and then slowly reveal to the audience the truth of what's actually happened. So there are two kind of things working in reverse. So what I wanted to do with that scene was first to give people a really cool scene quite early in the book, so that they read that scene and they think, okay, you know, because I build up quite slowly to begin with, but then the summoning scene kind of hits with quite a punch. But I also wanted people to feel a little, not confused or conflicted, but more sort of sad and curious. You know, so I wanted them to see what happened and think, okay, that's pretty grim. But at the same time, start to ask those questions. Why? Why did that happen? Why did Falco feel that way? And also, why are the dragons this way? Why would just a black dragon? So this is what I wanted to do, was to set all these questions. But it comes down, some of that comes down to this view of dragons that I started to develop years ago. Years ago in the paper, there was a competition to write a story in 50 words. So I entered this competition, and the first line of the story I wrote was, "The world knows no emotion to match a dragon's grief." And that's what I put at the start of Battle Mage, because I used that and developed that through the book. But the line goes on, "The world knows no emotion to match a dragon's grief, save perhaps a dragon's rage." So just in a couple of lines, you've got the image of dragons, you've got the image of grief, and you've got the image of rage. And that conflict between the sadness and the rage, I just find really powerful. And then you ask yourself, why? So that's the sort of combination of what I wanted to achieve. I wanted to have something that had real impact, something that was very exciting, very dramatic, but also tragic and thought-provoking. And it was also something that then gave me a huge amount of potential to develop through the rest of the book. So in terms of summoning, that's what it was all about. And if I go back a little bit further because the idea is that the battle mage goes to a particular place, sends out this call, which is like, it's like a tolling of the soul, like a giant bell. If you imagine a big bell being struck, boom, the waves of it go out into the world. But the dragons come in from maybe thousands of miles away. So there's some kind of weird thing whereby the dragon hears it a long time in the past and then arrives at the moment when the summoning is sent out. But that doesn't just come from nowhere. If you think of Gandalf summoning Shadowfax, you know, he stands on the fringes of Fangorn Forest, I can't remember exactly, and he whistles for this horse, and all of a sudden the horse appears as if it was just in the next meadow. But it doesn't. There's some kind of connection that was sent out beforehand. And if you think of like the Chronicles of Thomas Covenant, when they summon the horses, I think they're called the Ranyan. I don't know if you remember or you read that book. There's some kind of connection. So I kind of appropriated that a little bit and incorporated that into the summoning, because I have this idea in Battle Mage that events echo into the future. So you can have, you drop a stone in a pool and the ripples spread outwards into the future. But I also have this sense that things that in the future can echo back into the past. And on some kind of level, every now and again, people get a sense of something. They don't understand it. They don't know why they feel a particular way, but they get the sense that something might be important. And that was part of the thing with this summoning as well. So again, that's my best explanation.
No, and it's a great explanation. And the final point I want to talk about before we talk about some other aspects of Battle Mage is the Battle Mages themselves. So they're not just men. There's female Battle Mages as well. Yep. It's not particular to one sex, but the training scenes that we see in the Capitol are very intense. They're very vigorous. And the final trial they do before they have the ability or the privilege to do the calling. Yep. Those are some of the more visceral scenes and some of the in the book as well. It results to the training. How did you construct with the trials and how you wanted the emotional punches to come through on the page?
Yeah, so to begin with, the Battle Mages, this all goes back to dreams I had as a child or nightmares I had as a child. And I had these terrible nightmares for a long, long time. And one of the sort of signature features of these nightmares was that a dream scene would often begin quite benign, completely normal. You're walking down the promenade at the beach. You're eating an ice cream. It could be any kind of simple everyday event. But then something happens in the dream, and this sense, almost like ink or poison, starts to creep into your dream sense. And you suddenly have this horrible feeling that it's all going to go wrong. It's all going to go bad. And for me as a child, it felt like evil was creeping into my dream. But the thing about children having nightmares is that they have to deal with them on their own. The parents aren't there in the dream. Nobody's there in the dream. And this was a massive source of inspiration for me. It was terrible at the time, but you grow and you learn to deal with these dreams. So this is what I used as the basis for what a Battle Mage is. But the dreams in my book, the dreams in Battle Mage, are far worse than the dreams a normal person might feel in this world. They're essentially nightmares that can kill you, and that do kill children. So certain children, almost as if there were sort of certain people who had a psychic ability or something, they are beset by these horrible nightmares that could literally kill them, where they're faced with the prospect of becoming possessed. And those children that are strong enough to overcome these nightmares, they have the potential to grow up to become a Battle Mage. So it's not that Battle Mages are something special in one respect, but it's just this particular sort of part of their spirit or their soul or their character, whatever you want to call it, that allows them to believe they can defeat the evil. And that's massively powerful. So that's where you start from. So they don't feel the fear of the demons like normal people do, because they've already overcome it as children. So then you have to develop this skill. You have to develop these abilities. And I don't like to go into too much sort of explanation of magic, because I think at some point it's going to fall down, because magic is magic. It's not science that can be explained. So I don't go into too much detail about the magic itself, but what I do is I link the magic to the spirit of the individual, because that way you can use motivation as a source of energy, as a source of power. So a lot of people don't like magic unless it has some downside, you know, unless you pay a price for it. Where for me, I treated it more like you can get an individual who's pushed to their absolute limits. But if they suddenly then realize that they're actually what the hardship they're going through is for their wife and children or their spouse and children, then they suddenly find the strength to do that bit more. So if you link the power to the spirit of the individual, that gives you much more flexibility. But we're all beset with doubts. And those doubts, those self-doubts, those inner doubts, are the ones that are most likely to undo us. So that's what I played on when it came to the trials. So you start off developing this person's magical ability. You develop their strength of character, their faith, to the point where they can blast things with magical spells. They can protect themselves from physical damage. They can do all these sort of Jedi type of things. But they still have to have that point where they face their inner demons. They face the things that scare them most. And if you think of, you know, the Star Wars movie where Luke goes through the training with Yoda, but then he has to go through that weird sort of root cave type entrance. I don't know if you remember the scene where he's faced with the prospect of seeing Darth Vader, his dad, and then he looks inside and it's his face. So he's frightened of becoming his father. And in some respects, Falco was frightened of becoming like his father, who, you know, was a tragic figure. So I create this place called the Oubliette, or it's basically like a horrible dark tunnel filled with magi who are trying to use all their power to stop you. So they're going to hurt you as much as they can without killing you. They're going to frighten you as much as they can. They're going to use every trick in the book. But the problem with the magi is that the seeds of possession have been sown within the magi. So this brings a whole new, when Falco comes to go through his trials, that brings a whole new level of horror to his particular experience. So not only is he facing majors who've been building up power for weeks to try and stop him, he's also facing the embodiment of the evil possessed that has been placed in front of him. And for that, I basically use some of my own nightmare experiences, you know, the sort of imagery that I remember from my nightmares, or the images. If you think of some of the images from Japanese horror films, you know, like The Ring or The Grudge, where you're faced with, it might be a young girl, but there's something about the way she moves, you know, that sort of jerky, inhuman movement, or the way they look, that is absolutely terrifying. They're not a massive beast with teeth and claws. It's something more subtle, something more scary. So, yeah, it's overcoming the last remnants of their self-doubt, their inner fears. And once they can do that, they can claim their sword, and then they can go on to attempt to summon a dragon. But it was bringing all that real sense of evil and that real sense of danger, and overcoming the fear of pain, the fear of suffering, the fear of grief, the fear of guilt, packing all that into one particular scene, ended up being quite powerful. I really enjoyed writing it. It was a tricky one to write. But again, you've loaded it with things that have happened earlier in the book. So all the experience of the guilt and the shame that Falco feels about his father, the resentment that some people feel towards Falco adds to the, you know, the sort of consequences. And then the sense that the evil side really feels like they've got to stop this character. So everything is thrown at Falco. So that's really the point where, yeah, our hero starts to come of age. And then he emerges, but then he's got to face another challenge. And those sort of challenges each time, they just test his faith, test his strength. But each time there's a reason why he can overcome them.
So, brilliant.
Yeah.
I absolutely love those scenes. It really hit me for a gut punch. And there's many more emotional gut punches in the story. And there's also ones of relief and just puts a smile on your face. I'm not going to get into those because that's in the spoiler territories. But we'll keep that. But I heard you are going to be working on a prequel and sequel to Battle Mage. Is there anything you could tell us about that?
Yeah. I'm currently working on a prequel. And it basically tells the story of Falco's father. So again, we won't give too much away in terms of what actually happens, but it tells the story of Falco's father and how it led to the sort of, okay, it's a tragic story, Falco's father. Okay, let's not beat around the bush. But writing a tragic story is quite tricky because you don't want to leave your reader on a downer. You don't want to leave them at the end of the book thinking, oh, that was shite. You know, you want to, even though the end of the book might have sort of negative things, you still want to leave them with a sense of hope or with a sense of anticipation of what's going to come next. So when I was thinking about writing a prequel, I couldn't, in my head, I couldn't think of a sequel without thinking of what went before, and I couldn't think about a prequel without thinking about what happened after Battle Mage. So what I decided to do was write the prequel and the sequel almost like bookends to the main book. But that gave me a massive challenge and a real headache, because writing a book, any book, is difficult, you know, to get everything to sort of flow nicely and work well. But what I wanted to do was write a prequel that referred to the main book, but also set up the sequel. So it has threads that start in the prequel that kind of some work their way through Battle Mage and some kind of arc over Battle Mage and come into the sequel. But that in itself introduces loads of problems as a writer, because when you're writing a fantasy book, you want to maintain a sense of momentum that carries the reader through the book. But if you're using other threads, those two things can work against each other. So every time you introduce a new thread, it slows down the pace of another thread. So trying to navigate those things is proving to be a massive challenge. But I've started to find an approach, and I've started to sort of wrestle things into place to the point where I feel as if it's working. So I'm making reasonable progress on the prequel, and obviously I'm making notes and working in my head on how this is going to translate into the sequel. So it's a challenge. It's not as straightforward a progression as Battle Mage. Battle Mage had a very nice, clean, linear line of progression, with Falco getting stronger, the threat getting greater, and it all coming to a nice, crunchy climax at the end. With the prequel, it's not as straightforward a story as that. So it'll be a different experience, but hopefully it will have some of the same kind of emotional impact and some of the same excitement and drama. And then some of that complexity hopefully will translate through into the sequel. So that's where I'm up to at the moment. And we'll see how it turns out.
But Battle Mage is not your only book that you wrote. You have another story out there called First and Only, which I have not read yet. Could you tell the audience a little bit about that before we let you go?
Yeah, sure. So First and Only was the first book I tried to get published. And I ended up publishing it myself, because I am a self-published author. And it tells the story of the world's first genuine psychic. I've always been fascinated by psychic ability and things like that. I got to the point where I used to go to visit psychics and palm readers or all these different kind of things, because I was desperate to believe that it was true. But the more I sort of looked into it and the more experience I had, the more I started to come to the reluctant conclusion that it wasn't actually true. There weren't any genuine psychics in the world. So that was the position I ended up in. But then that for me, that raised the question, what if there was? What if there really was somebody in the world who could read people's minds, see into the future, and move things with their minds? What kind of person would they be? What kind of consequences would they have? How would they reveal themselves to the world? And what kind of things could threaten them? So if you've got somebody with that kind of power, for a reader to like them, you have to make them non-threatening. Because if you were to sit in a room with somebody who could read your most intimate thoughts without you being able to stop them, you'd feel very insecure, very vulnerable, and that wouldn't be a comfortable thing. But if you were in the presence of somebody who you knew would never abuse their powers, you'd feel much more comfortable. So that was the basis. So I created this character called Simon, and it's Simon spelt with a P. So yes, it's literally Simon. And I just made him a nice, vulnerable young man who happened to have these incredible powers. And then set against him, I created this character called Lucifer, who was basically a serial killer who had delusions. So he was under the impression that these delusions, these voices in his head, were essentially a chorus of angels, dark angels, telling him what to do. And anybody who denied the reality of these angels was a heretic that needed to be killed. So he starts hunting down psychologists and psychotherapists, people who might say, oh, you know, these voices in your head aren't actually real, because to say that is blasphemy, as far as he's concerned. So you end up with this nice young guy with all these powers and this massive, like 6'8", built like a massive wrestler, evil psychopath serial killer. And the balance between the two is overbearingly on the favor of the psychopath. But if Simon was able to use his powers, then he would use his powers to defeat this psychopath. But Simon is handicapped or undermined by a sense of fear. So very much the same as Battle Mage. You've got this battle of wills, this battle of faith. Simon's terrified because he met this killer when he was only a child, and it left this impression on this young child. And it created these blind spots in his vision. So he can see into the future, and he knows he's going to die. He knows he's going to be killed by this Lucifer character. So he has that vision, but he can't see beyond that. He can't see when it's going to happen, how it's going to happen. He can't do anything to stop it. He just knows it's going to happen. So he enlists the help of an ex-Special Forces soldier who does like security work and bodyguard work. And he gets this guy and he basically sort of says to him, you have to help me. And the guy says, why? He says, because in 5 days' time, you're going to kill me. And he's like, what? I'm not going to kill you. And that starts the relationship between these two characters. And then Steve is this character, this military guy, and he's essentially the reader. He's essentially you and me, who he gets to learn about Simon's powers. He becomes convinced of Simon's powers, and then he becomes convinced that he has to protect him. And then he has to go up against this massive, big serial killer psychopath to try and save Simon. And again, it all comes to an end with these characters coming together. And you're not quite sure how it's going to work out, how all the little threads are going to play out. But it's got the same elements as Battle Mage. At the core of it, it's friendship, it's loyalty, it's having faith, you know, in the people we love. And it's good overcoming evil. So in many ways, it's a similar story. But it's a short, fast, psychological thriller. You read it in a weekend easily. So give it a try and let me know what you think.
Well, I definitely will. Marked it to read on my TBR. Brilliant. So, well, Peter, this has been lovely. Before we let you go, could you tell our audience members where they could find you on Twitter or your website, and where they can find Battle Mage?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter. I go under the name of The Flanston. I do have a website, which I'm terrible at updating, but you'll find me at peterflannery.co.uk. If you want to drop me a line through my website, I'd be happy to reply, you know, via email, or you can send me a note on Twitter and I'll always reply on there. My books are available through Amazon, so you can get them as ebooks, paperback if you want, and they're also available as audiobooks. I don't have a hardback copy available at the moment, but I'm trying to look into different ways that might be possible. So what I'm hoping is that when I get the prequel out and the sequel, then I can possibly produce some nice quality hardbacks for, you know, I know some people really like to collect the hardbacks, and particularly some of these really beautiful hardbacks that are being produced now. They're like collector's pieces, they're works of art. So yeah, that's where you can find me. That's where you can find my books. And if you drop me a line on Twitter or through my website, I'd be very happy to say hello.
Thank you so much, Peter. Again, guys, Battle Mage, my favorite epic fantasy standalone of all time. I'm sure it'll be yours if you ever get a chance to pick it up. So, Peter, thank you so much for joining me, and let's do this again sometime.
My pleasure. Thanks very much, Blaise.
Cheers.